Christmas is important, but Easter is decisive. That deep theological insight came from the lips of Arsene Wenger, the manager of Arsenal Football Club. He was talking about the Premier League, and I suspect after yesterday's result, he hopes that he was right. But he was speaking wiser than he knew. And this familiar story on the Emmaus Road is the story of a decisive Easter. But it comes in many layers, which will no doubt speak to different ones of us. You know, imagine it as a film. I don't know what kind of movies you look for, but at first glance, this is comedy. You know the kind of comedy where the gag's based on us, the viewer, knowing what's going on, while the bumbling hero stumbles from one incident to another, muddling his way through. You know, Rowan Atkinson would play him very well. Well, you can't read this story with too straight a face. I'm sure Luke saw the funny side of what was going on. I mean, look at where he starts, back in verse 13. Now, that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. They were talking with each other about everything that had happened, and as they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked along with them, but they were kept from recognizing him. So the scene set, and for the next couple of hours, the two are talking about Jesus without knowing they're talking to him. I mean, if it was a pantomime, we'd all be shouting out, "He's beside you! He's beside you!" I mean, Luke's got to be enjoying a good chuckle, hasn't he, as he pens verse 18. One of them, named Cleopas, asked Jesus, "Are you the only one who doesn't know the things that have happened?" And as they talk on, you suddenly realize how many pieces of the jigsaw they have without knowing how to put them together. See, look, verse 19, they knew Jesus as a powerful prophet. Verse 21, they spoke about the third day after his crucifixion as if that was significant. As if they'd remembered Jesus predicting his death and 3 days later he would rise. They know about the women finding an empty tomb in verses 22 and 23. Mind you, the others thought their story was nonsense too, back in verse 11. No doubt sexism was alive and well then. And as so often, the women will have the last laugh. Women, angels, disciples, some of our companions, verse 24, they all speak of an empty tomb, but Cleopas and friend do not get it. You do rather hope that Cleopas has a sense of humour. You know, a little later, one day, he is going to buy Luke's bestseller and discover that he is going down in history as the man who looked Jesus in the face and said, "No one saw him." Well, even the extraordinarily patient Jesus says, verse 25, "How foolish you are. How slow." Not even Jesus' Bible teaching is going to make the penny drop. Now, we enjoy laughing at others' slowness, even sometimes at our own. It doesn't have to be mean, but there's a serious point to this comedy. Luke seems to have known the couple, probably interviewed them for his story. He names Cleopas presumably because he was known in the wider Christian community. The gospel writers are not precious about their leaders. You know, Peter's blunderings, Thomas's doubting, everyone's deserting. I mean, they all get scripted in. They know that discipleship and ministry and even leadership comes from grace and not merit. And here, as he smiles to himself and writes their story, Luke is writing to let us know you don't have to be the sharpest knife in the box to be a disciple. How slow. Yes, but they got there. God's grace has got room for the thick and the slow to get it. And that is an encouragement. That is almost certainly a personal encouragement for some of us here, but do not look around for the one you think. If how slow is one theme that runs through the story, it's not the only one. And if one strand has a comic element and brings a smile to your face, another is very different. It's more tragedy than comedy. We had hoped is the dominant idea that comes through this theme. It's the dominant idea in Cleopas' mind on this walk. Look down at verse 21. we had hoped he was the one. They'd obviously invested so much in Jesus, and Good Friday has dashed their hopes cruelly. His death, his crucifixion, his execution has locked them into despondency. You know, when you've been burnt, when your hopes have been dashed, you don't trust again very easily. You can understand it, can't you? A little while back, a friend gave me this book. It's called Do No Harm. And the subtitle is Stories of Life, Death, and Brain Surgery. When a friend who is a palliative care nurse gives you out of the blue a book on brain surgery, you wonder what she's trying to tell you, don't you? I was at least encouraged that whatever she thought was wrong with my brain, she clearly thought that surgery might cure it. But when I started reading, I realized she didn't really give it to me for anything to do with brain surgery. It is just a very well-written book with very frank honesty by a surgeon whose every operation is going to make a massive difference to someone's life, either for good or a few millimeters either way for harm, who has to live with all of those tensions and, you know, with the great triumphs and the self-importance they bring and the awful failures and what comes after them. He tells of one operation which left a young mother paralyzed down the right side. And then he writes of going to see her on the ward a few days later. And, you know, any of us who've gone to what we know is going to be an awkward interview will empathize with what he says about coming to meet someone like that. When you approach a patient you've damaged, he writes, it feels as though there's a force field pushing against you, resisting your attempts to open the door behind which the patient is lying, the handle of which feels as though it were made of lead, pushing you away from the patient's bed, resisting your strength to raise a hesitant smile. It's hard to know what role to play. The surgeon is now a villain and perpetrator, at best an incompetent, no longer heroic and all-powerful. It's much easier to hurry past the patient without saying anything. I went into the room, sat down on the chair beside her. "How are you?" I asked lamely. And she looked at me and grimaced and, pointing wordlessly with her good left arm to her paralyzed right arm and then lifting it up to let it fall lifeless back onto the bed. "I've seen this happen after surgery before," I said. "And the patients got better, although it took months. I really do believe you will get largely better." "I believed you before the operation," she said. "Why should I trust you now? Why should I trust you now?" You feel here Cleopas and his friend are saying, we trusted before the crucifixion. How can we trust now? You know, some of us, no doubt, watched Maundy Thursday's 7 party leaders strung across the stage and no clear winner. They'd watched Good Friday, 1 party leader and a decisive vote. Crucify, crucify, crucify. The black cloud over them is almost visible, the disillusionment tangible, isn't it? And all the clear signs of it. Their faces downcast, verse 17. They're bewildered, verses 19 to 24. They got all the pieces, can't put them together, they're blind. And what had happened to their religion? Well, look at verse 21. We had hoped he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. That's what Messiah was meant to do, and he can't pull it off now, can he? I don't know whether Cleopas had been there on Palm Sunday, singing the nationalist songs, waving the nationalist flags, putting the palms down, but certainly the Old Testament types of a liberator who would free his people from occupying powers, who would end the exile, they were heavily in his mind. We had hoped. Those 3 words sum up the ashes of many a person's faith, don't they? Not so much these days people who've been recruiting Jesus to a nationalist cause. Not so much his death that brings disillusionment anymore. We know the story before we start now. But others' deaths. We had hoped. Why, we'd even prayed when our friend was ill. There's only one thing I asked of God. And no. Not his plans being scuppered that make us disillusioned so much as ours, is it? We had hoped. You know, if God had healed my child, if God had mended my marriage, if only God had opened that job opportunity, but no. We had hoped. We had hoped there was a God living and relevant and a force for good in the 21st century. We thought of him like that once. And we talked of him like that. We sang of him like that. We had hoped. But not any longer. You know people like that? You know anything of that sadness and bewilderment? For some, the sadness has turned into a sneer, a sort of patronizing smile. Oh yes, we had hoped. We too were once naive. Now we've grown out of it. For others, there just remains the heavy heart of a broken idealism. We had hoped he was the one. How foolish you are. How slow. How thick. I mean, just when you expect Jesus to be at his sensitive, tender best, he's shockingly robust. And as he so consistently is with those of us whose problem is that we are slow, Jesus is remarkably patient too. You see in verse 27? And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. Now, I doubt that Jesus was peppering them with proof texts, but for the couple of hours it would have taken to walk to Emmaus, he took them on a tour of the Old Testament from Genesis through to Malachi. I'm afraid there isn't a recording of it. I just wish Pam Glover was older. Pam is the one who puts all our sermons on the web for us, so kind of in a couple of days' time. And if she'd been around, she would have made sure there was a recording of this. But she is unfortunately far too young. We'll have to work it out for ourselves. As Jesus explained what was promised about the Christ, the Messiah. A figure of great power and justice, certainly. A figure to rescue his people and end their exile, definitely. But as he would have pointed out from the Passover and Exodus, to the suffering servant we heard about in our first reading from Isaiah, a figure too who would rescue through sacrifice, who would taste God's judgment himself so that his people could escape it, whose road to triumph was deliberately rooted through the death he would face for his rebellious people. So verse 26, did not the Christ have to suffer these things and then enter his glory? And Cleopas, you see, is exposed to all the scriptures and it changes his expectations. We had hoped he was going to be the one to redeem Israel and he'd assumed that Jesus' death meant he couldn't be the one. Now he's heard that death was part of the deal. Written into Messiah's job description, part of the rescue package, meant that God's Messiah was working off a different agenda to Cleopas's. Now, when you're faced with disillusionment, now, in order to prevent disillusionment, I must keep exposing myself to the scriptures. See, will we keep checking our expectations against God's? Will you judge God by your plans or by his? Will I view God in the light of my vision or his vision? Have we let Easter truth? The Christ had to suffer these things and then enter his glory. Have we let Easter truth speak to our disillusionment? We had hope. Yes, Easter knows that sense of despair. But it offers a hope that does not fade. How slow. But Easter encourages those who struggle to see it. We had hoped, but Easter speaks up for and to the disillusioned. And there's another strand. Because this incident doesn't end in despair and disillusionment. It finishes as a feel-good movie. Technically, I'm told, originally, a comedy wasn't so much something that gives you belly laughs, it's something that has a happy ending. Well, as you get to the end of this incident, there's a growing sense of excitement as it reaches its climax. They reach Emmaus. Jesus is persuaded to stay. And as he breaks bread, verse 31, then their eyes were opened and they recognized him. We're not quite told how. Maybe it was just the familiar gesture of breaking bread. Maybe as he lifted up his hands, his sleeves slipped down and they saw the nail marks on his wrists. Maybe they'd recovered a perspective and they could see the facts for what they were and Jesus for who he is, the risen Messiah, whatever. It makes sense of their experience. Were not our hearts burning within us as he opened the scriptures to us? Burning because of relief at things making sense. Burning because of the excitement at a vision which both overwhelmed their own expectations and was deeply satisfying. And they couldn't keep the truth to themselves. I heard last week about a woman who, after some searching and several Bible studies, put her faith in Jesus. She was with a minister when she did it, and his advice to her as she left that morning was to say, look, tell someone else today about what you've done. So she went home, and she got out her address book, and she picked up her phone, and she worked her way through it. Family, friends, neighbours, acquaintances, the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, they all got a phone call as she told them, I'd become a Christian. And, you know, 3 hours later, she sat back finished. And the other end of the phone, there's a trail of excited, bemused, puzzled, what on earth was that all about, friends left behind her. Well, Cleopas had got no phone and almost certainly didn't have an address book, but he gets his coat on. And I rather feel for poor Cleopas's friend, who's probably just sunk down in the armchair after a long day and evening is coming. And Cleopas says, no, get up, get your coat on, we're going back. Verse 33, they got up, they returned at once to Jerusalem. They rushed to tell their friends, to share the news. I mean, Easter has that effect. It can't keep itself to itself, any more than the grave could keep Jesus to itself. I don't know if it's done that for you yet, or whether none of us have moved past the stage of being British where you just kind of nod even at the most revolutionary truth. But, I mean, here's the tough news for Cleopas. He does the sort of 7 mile power walk back and still doesn't get a chance to tell his story, and he finds he's already too late for it to be news. See, look at verse 33. There they found the 11 and those with them assembled together and saying, it is true, the Lord has risen. They've seen it. It is true, is the final Easter phrase. And you see how it counters all the despair. We had hoped Jesus was the Messiah. It is true. The Lord has risen. Jesus is Messiah, Lord, King, Rescuer. Easter turns, we had hoped, back into, we still hope. We still have confidence. He is the one. We had hoped in sins forgiven. He was pierced for our transgressions. It is true. And it brings hope where we have no right to any. I came this week across the story of Dawit. Dawit was a murderer, a rapist, a thief. He was feared and hated around his town in rural Ethiopia. Family disowned him, he terrorized women, he raped them, he robbed them, he killed them, ran away to live wild in the forest for months at a time. And when Dawit was finally captured, he received a double life sentence. Not quite sure what that is, but I take it it's a very long time. And he was imprisoned. I deserve to be in that horrible cell, he said. There was no hope for me. But God had other ideas. And Dawit continues, one day, during recess, a black box appeared in the communal room. I used to sit in the corner of the room, far from anyone, but I couldn't ignore the sound coming from the box. It turned out to be a box the Bible Society provided with an audio Bible on. And the voice that day was speaking about a God who died for our sins. I listened closely. I could hear three voices. One was Jesus. The other two were sinners. And all were being crucified. And one sinner said they were being killed for a reason. But Jesus didn't do anything to deserve his fate. It got me thinking. And as I listened more, it talked about God's unfailing love for all of humanity. That night, I couldn't sleep. The message stuck with me. Even though I was rejected by society, Jesus Christ accepted me and loved me no matter what. So the next day, I heard some more. Over that week, I discovered Jesus as my personal Lord and Savior. He's taken me in his arms. He's loved me like his son, no matter how bad the crimes I've committed. He's freed me from the chains of evil, given me another chance. That was 10 years ago. Dawit's now 46. He's still in prison in Addis Ababa. Today he has the role of prison pastor and coordinates the daily Bible listening group, and the warders trust and respect him. He has 25 years left to serve in jail. But he says, God put me here for a reason. I'm helping so many other men to change their ways and discover God. I'm happy to still be in this prison because it's my mission to share God's love with everyone. We had hope. No, Dawit hadn't even dared hope in sins forgiven. But it is true. Sins are forgiven. That's the Easter message. We had hoped death would not have the final word. But 147, 148 Christian brothers and sisters massacred in Kenya on Thursday by Al-Shabaab. Some girls, one eyewitness account reported, were praying in front of their captors, and they then prayed, "Jesus, help us," and were immediately shot. We had hoped. But what will friends and family say now? What will anyone say to friends and family? It is true. The Lord has risen, and so will those who trust in him. "I am the resurrection and the life," Jesus promised. And it wasn't just a statement in a church on a Sunday morning. No, no, this was to family, friends, sisters of a man who died 4 days previously. You don't just throw lines out, you can't deliver on there. "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live, even though he dies." And Jesus not only promised, he blazed the trail, he pioneered the route. We do hope, we are still confident, he is the one to redeem Israel, to rescue the people of God, to bring them even through death to his new creation world. So this Easter, which phrase is you? How slow? How slow, but Easter includes the slow. We had hoped, but Easter renews hope. If those phrases are still you, well, why not fill in the flyer? A great way to explore further and no further. Or have you got to the real message of Easter? It is true. The Lord has risen. In which case, in a few minutes' time, take the bread. Drink the wine, remember the death, taste the triumph. It is finished. The price has been paid. The debt has been cleared. Enjoy the confidence. Face the present and the future. Why not raise the cup as a toast? It is true. The Lord has risen.